this recent visit of Putin to China that was so different and so amazing that we've seen they're embracing each other, Xi and Putin. Did you find it differently from what we've seen so far, or you see a series of evolving and getting better and deeper these relationship between Russia and China?
No, there's absolutely nothing different about it, Nima. I have last week was totally crazy because I was on the road in Italy all the time, so I didn't have time to sit down, not even for 10 minutes to write a proper column about it. I'm doing this now. And obviously I'm outside. I am in Doha now, so I am already in back in Eurasia. And of course, with the whole Raisi story in front of us. So it's absolutely crazy, literally. But what I'm trying to do later tonight, after I talk to you and your audience, deep in the middle of the night, quiet here in the souk in Doha, I will try to write a column connecting exactly what you just mentioned, which is one of the most important meetings of the 21st century, for that matter. And let's say the third man in the picture, which unfortunately is not there anymore. We can call him President Martir Raisi. Because the three most important actors in our drive towards multipolarity, they remain the same. They are Russia, China, and Iran. The two crucial ones, of course, are Russia and China. And the two, let's, and the one relatively new arrival, but also extremely important in terms of West Asia, in terms of the lands of Islam, and as one of the leaders of the global majority, is Iran. So the tragedy that happened with Raisi and his excellent foreign minister Abdollahian is, of course, deeply saddens all of us, especially coming only a few days after this absolutely extraordinary meeting in Beijing, which many of us expected, of course, let's say like the apex of the personal relationship between Putin and Xi. For the past few years, and with a delicious symmetry. After his inauguration, Xi Jinping's inauguration in China, Putin met him exactly 10 days afterwards. And now, exactly 10 days after Putin's re-inauguration in Moscow, he meets Xi Jinping. So even these little extremely significant details are quite something. It's of course this escapes those lowly intellects in the beltway, right? But it's predictable. The most important thing is I would say is not only the 12,000 word, let's put it this way, joint statement, Russia-China joint statement, Putin-Xi joint statement. The fact that they are collaborating and increasing their collaboration partnership in virtually every area, but also, of course, the personal warmth between both. That's a wonderful, like in Italy, we say in Italia, passeggiata, né? That little walk together that they had just with the two translators and talking to each other like friends. That was absolutely extraordinary. It shows not only to Russia and China, internal public opinion, the whole of Eurasia, but the whole planet, that this is on a whole new level. And take them very, very seriously, which is something that, of course, that's what I call NATO stan doesn't. And okay. To their own peril, as they are learning and they will continue not to learn in the immediate future. But in terms of not only a geopolitical and geoeconomic agenda and their internal agendas also merging, and increasing trade and everything that they are doing very, very carefully towards de-dollarization. This was a meeting for the ages, of course. And that's why it will continue to be misunderstood or neglected or both across the West. But nobody cares about it. The Russians don't care about it. The Chinese don't care about it. And the partnership doesn't care about it anymore.
Yeah. Before this visit of Putin, we had new tariffs that Biden put on Chinese, and from 25% to 100%. That was a gift, I think, to this meeting between Xi and Putin. It's unbelievable how they're managing everything in Washington. It seems that nobody is in charge there.
Because, Nima, it's not only between their ministries, or it's personal. And obviously, we know that they pick up the phone and they talk to each other outside of their several personal face-to-face meetings every year. And when they meet in a different summits, they will meet again at the CEO, the SCO summit later this year. They'll meet again the BRICS summit. So it's a, and they might even meet at the G20 in Rio in November as well. So they keep meeting each other. So obviously, decisions, they flow like this. Some of these decisions are horizontal, of course, but some are like a pyramid, and they come from the two leaders at the top. And of course, both systems, they look up to Xi and Putin with a mix of profound respect and even awe. They are respected as leaders of civilizational states, and the mechanism on both sides in Moscow and Beijing understands that this is a civilization state partnership. It's not only two nation states. It goes way beyond that. And on top of it, on a crucial crossroads of history where we have the declining power reaching a stage of internal disintegration, paranoia, and a feeling of being cornered, and everything slipping away from the elites that control the hegemon and the vassals, that the world that they built for the past 75 years, it doesn't exist anymore. So all that, this peer relation partnership scares the hell out of them. Not only the Beltway, not only Washington, Virginia, Maryland, and financial elites in New York, but especially the vassals across the Atlantic. Europe, I just came back this morning from NATO's town. And some of the things that I heard in Italy, where we still find critical spirits in nodes, of course, not in terms of the leadership in Rome, which is an absolute disaster, but in academia, and you know, the intellectual life in Italy is still very, very powerful, with a fabulous tradition of centuries, if not two and a half millennia of thinking. And what they told me about the way Italy is completely cornered and subjugated by NATO, especially, which subjugates the EU and, of course, subjugates Rome as well, is absolutely mind-boggling. Including secret NATO bases all across, all over NATO, Italy. I was very close to some of them, for that matter, early last week. The way that the corruption in Rome, especially after the failed Five Stars experiment, now is even worse than it was a decade ago, or two or three decades ago. So, and it's a pity to see that Italy is a civilization state. We all know that Western culture and Western civilization owes almost everything of exceptionalism in a good aesthetic sense, and even political philosophy sense, to Italy. And now they are what American generals tell their Italian counterparts in their faces all the time. AMGOT, American Government Occupied Territory. This will never happen with these three, Russia, China, and Iran.
Yeah. It seems that the level of friendship and partnership that we're witnessing right now, we couldn't imagine this before this conflict in Ukraine started to be at this level, this deep. It seems that they were on the way to have deeper relationship, but this conflict in Ukraine just accelerated the process of getting closer and create a vital partnership between Russia, China, Iran. We know that right now when Xi just simply hugging Putin, it means a lot because they have security in common, they have economy in common. You have military, their military are so connected right now because they need each other. And you see economy, security, military, and it's all there. And what's the reason not to be so close? What the reason not to be so friendly to each other?
Exactly, Nima, because personally, both leaders understood the gravity of the moment. And they understood that both civilizational state apparatuses on both sides, they are ready to tackle the challenge, which is an absolutely intergalactic challenge, if we can put it this way. It's to change a system of international relations. It's nothing less than that. Change the system of international relations, make a new system that is equanimous and open to everybody, where everybody has a real seat on the table. A more equal partnership all across in different areas of the planet, a new international financial system and geoeconomic system. So the challenge is, of course, it's tremendous, but they give us the impression that they don't feel the pressure on top of it. And when they meet and when they talk to each other, of course, they are talking about all these enormous issues. Like the first meeting in Beijing lasted at least 2.5 hours. But then at night, there was an extra meeting later in the night, only the two of them with the interpreters, where they were discussing essentially Ukraine, NATO, and the US. That's it, exclusively. Because they know that this is the key issue. But this the perception from outside for everyone is that they are on top of their game, which is something that when you compare to, I would say, the bunch of headless chickens that appear to be the political leadership in the US, is the exact opposite. The real adults in the room tackling enormous problems, and they have time to be polite to each other. They find time to discuss this over and over again. They project an atmosphere of competence, especially. The contrast with the West could not be sharper.
Do you think that the hope for the United States to separate China from Russia is passing away?
Yes, it's absolutely well, it never existed in the first place, Nima, because when they came up with this absolutely brilliant idea that, by the way, was invented by the Roman Empire over 2,000 years ago, divide et impera in Latin, divide and rule, and then picked up by the British Empire in the 19th, and the Americans, who are never come up with any actually original formulations, they picked it up from the Brits. Iran was already more or less embarking in what under Raisi defined as the look east policy, and Russia was already deep into their pivot to Asia policy. This was not only provoked but as a by the Americans and as a reaction to the Americas. It's the fact that the leadership in Moscow and the leadership in Tehran, they looked around them across Eurasia and they saw that the future is Eurasia integration as a whole. The future is the heartland and everything around it, including the Rimland as well. So what's happening now from an American point of view? They are running the risk of losing the Rimland, which they thought that they had already conquered after Second World War, especially. So, you know, it's they all go back to the same things that they keep regurgitating again and again, theoretically. Mackinder, Mahan, Spikeman, these are the three that they keep low. You cannot lose the Rimland. You can use the Rimland to fight against the Heartland. You cannot lose the Heartland by any means, etc. So now they're losing all of them together, simultaneously. Especially because of the actions and the coordinating actions of this strategic partnership, Russia-China. But, very important, the interlocking strategic partnerships, because Russia-China strategic partnership is mirrored by Iran-China and Iran-Russia. These three are in the partnerships are so complex because they are interlocked. It's the same mechanism, essentially. And the clearest example, which we can give for the past 24 hours, in fact, like we're speaking at night in Doha. You know what happened yesterday night in Moscow at 10 p.m.? All of you listening. Putin called a special session of his crème de la crème in defense. His defense council, essentially, with some members of the Security Council. Sunday night, 10 p.m. Usually nothing happens Sunday night, 10 p.m. in Russia or anywhere else for that matter. And they called who? The Iranian ambassador in Moscow. So look at the enormity of this thing. They became aware that the Raisi situation was extremely sensitive immediately, irrespective of if it was an accident or if it was not. We still don't know. What I just heard a few minutes ago from people in Tehran is that, oh, look, everybody in Tehran, everybody at the top is saying it was an accident. But we don't know what that means deeply. Maybe it was not. Maybe they prefer not to get into details. Maybe they wait for the investigation. Probably that's the point. They will wait for the investigation. They don't want to create extra tension. The Russians already knew that probably 10 minutes after they learned about the disappearance of the helicopter and the fact that the other two helicopters did not disappear and they were flying the exact same route. So we have on the same table, pay attention, the new Russian Minister of Defense. We have the Chief of the Armed Forces, the Chief of the General Staff, Gerasimov. We have Shoigu, Minister of Defense, who is now a Secretary of the Security Council. We have one of Putin's top advisors. We have the ministers in charge of help, internal and external, all sorts of infrastructure help. And in the case of Iran, saying what Russia could send immediately to help Iran in the search for Raisi's helicopter. And we have the Iranian ambassador in Moscow. This is extremely important, especially for one thing. This was Putin's message directly to the whole leadership of Tehran, essentially, and I'm going to be very succinct here. We got your back. Whatever happens, you can count on us. It's part of our strategic partnership. We know that this is a very, very, very serious moment for you. We know that there are a lot of usual suspects make profit to destabilize Iran starting tonight, yesterday night, right? So we are with you and you can count on us. This is extremely important. It proves to all of you how deep is this strategic partnership. This is a meeting that usually never takes place, but it did. And the message of this meeting couldn't be clearer, especially to the other side who may start having, in fact, many of them are having ideas. Iran is going to plunge into chaos now. The continuity and the strengths of the Iranian system continue. It's inbuilt in the Iranian constitution. Iran doesn't depend on one individual or two or three individuals. No, it depends on how the system works. So I'll give all of you another example. This Tuesday in Astana, Kazakhstan, is the meeting of the foreign ministers of the SCO. Guess what? Iran is going to send the interim foreign minister, Bagheri, he was number two to Abdullahian. So what Abdullahian would be doing in Astana, Bagheri will do exactly the same thing. This is continuity. And he will be as respected as Abdullahian by all the SCO interlocutors, you know. So these examples are extremely important. Of course, Western public opinion have absolutely no clue how this works. But Russians know how it works, Iranians know how it works, and many people around here know how it works. Like where I am now in Doha is the same thing. I'm going to have a meeting with somebody who knows about West Asia intel a lot, and I'm going to learn a lot from him. But these people, they follow in detail everything important that happens in Russia, in Iran, and the whole of West Asia.
We had Xi's visit to Europe that was so much important. He went to France, Serbia, and Hungary. And when we look at Hungary and Serbia, which was the main reason for this visit, in my opinion, these are two landlocked countries, and the European Union can easily manipulate them and just force them. But right now, if we consider this partnership of China together with what Russia can provide them in terms of this access to the Black Sea, and that would be hugely in the benefit of these two countries in the future. Do you see one of these countries or maybe both of them joining BRICS in the future? How do you see these changes that are happening in the eastern part of Europe?
It could certainly happen, Nima. Let's say mid to long term. Because the first thing that should happen, considering what awaits NATO in the battlefields of Novorossiya, once again, that cosmic humiliation of the whole NATO system, that will lead to the disintegration of NATO. And in many other aspects as well, the disintegration in parallel of the European Union. Let's say that both are practically on a dead end street, and there's a huge wall in front of them. They are riding fast, and the crash will be inevitable. So it will be disintegration for both vehicles, which in many cases is only one vehicle. So, the fact that Hungary completely disagrees with virtually everything that comes out of Brussels, because they know exactly how it works. The orders come from Washington, they go to NATO, and from NATO, they go to European Commission. And Orbán and Ungheris, look, this has nothing to do with us. And this is practically foreign interference in Hungary. He's one of the very few leaders across Europe who understands how the mechanism works and disagrees with it, even vocally. The case of Serbia is even more complicated because they are small and they are totally surrounded by NATO. So China, which now they look at the West, they look at Europe as a series of nodes where they can engage it's like a game of Go. When you play Go, the black, no, those black little balls, you get a node, you surround the node, and you can capture, let's put it this way, this node for you. We're not talking about China capturing nodes in Europe, but China capturing in soft power terms, definitely in terms of investing in key crucial nodes in Europe. And these nodes will be very beneficial, not only for their own internal development, but in terms of cross-border and cross-continent trade commerce with China. And Hungary and Serbia, two of these nodes, are very, very specifically important. Greece is another one. In Italy, they had some very important ones in the ports. They still continue. For instance, I was in the port of Trieste only a week ago, which is considers itself a free port. And it's a very, very long story. It's a fantastic story. They presented me lots of documents proving how Trieste practically is an independent republic, which was then, let's say, took over by the Italian state. And the Chinese are very much present in the port of Trieste, and they won't go away. They will try to increase their participation in running the port of Trieste, which is essential. Adriatic port in terms of commerce by China with the Mediterranean and parts of Eastern Europe. So this is what the Chinese do best, how to expand their formerly Silk Road and informally Silk Road nodes all across the world. What they're doing in Africa, what they do in parts of Latin America, what they do all over Central Asia, and what they do in Eastern Europe as well.
What China and Russia are doing is so different from what we've seen so far for decades from the West. It seems that China understands that at the end of the day, if these nations, Africans, Eastern Europe, in Middle East, if they grow in terms of their infrastructure, in terms of their economy, that would be a benefit for China and Russia. It seems that it's a long-term strategy, but they're doing this little by little.
Of course it is a long-term strategy. It's how do you organize the system of international relations and international trade geoeconomically? It's a geoeconomic strategy. The Chinese, they came up with the Belt and Road Initiative in 11 years ago, actually. It was in 2013. The original idea was Russia. The original idea, years before, and Putin said it explicitly, let's have an enormous free trade zone from Lisbon to Vladivostok. This was the embryo of what the Chinese later on developed as the New Silk Road, which if we look only at Eurasia, would be a free trade zone between Shanghai and Xi'an all the way to Madrid. It's exactly the same thing. And of course, from a Chinese point of view, because they have the geoeconomic firepower and those enormous funds, Africa, Eurasia, and Latin America, Eurasia as well. So it's nearly global. The new Silk Roads encompass at least 80% of the planet. And the Russians, a few years later, after 2013, the new Silk Roads, they came up with the concept of a Greater Eurasia Partnership, which is an official concept in Russia. And one of the conceptualizers was Sergei Karaganov. I had the pleasure to talk to Karaganov at his office in late 2018 in Moscow. And these were the finishing touches of a Greater Eurasia Partnership, where it was about to be officially the Kremlin would start referring to it directly as official Russian policy. So it's essentially the same thing. Eurasia Partnership and the Silk Roads is a geoeconomic integration, trade and commerce, that is also geopolitical, because it changes the system that is always geared towards the lines of communication and the channels of communication and the maritime channels of communication controlled by the hegemonic power. For instance, If we have an international north-south transportation corridor, Russia, Iran, India, going to Russia all the way to Astrakhan, crossing the Caspian, and then down to the Persian Gulf, and then down to Mumbai. What do you skip? The Suez Canal, which is essentially controlled by the Americans, essentially. So this is a graphic example of how the whole pattern of international trade relations and commercial relations is being changed little by little. And that later on will lead us towards the possibility of the adoption of the Petro-Yuan, midterm to long term. The fact that one of the key reasons to bring Saudi Arabia to the BRICS table is to have Russia, China, Iran, India discussing with Saudi Arabia, okay, let's try to establish a different pattern of commercial trade relations. And sooner or later, you're going to have to say bye-bye to the US dollar. And MBS, he's not a fool. He may be a very complicated character. He's not a fool. He understands the stakes. So this is how the whole thing, the whole chessboard is being changed in real time, all the time, especially driven by these two main actors. The beginning of our conversation, how you started our conversation. It's all about what Russia and China do together, deliberate together. Then they try to explain to their top partners everywhere. They're going to be discussing this tomorrow in Astana at the SCO meeting, the foreign relations meeting. They're going to be discussing it next month in Moscow at the BRICS ministerial meeting, which is going to be extremely important for the roadmap towards the summit in Kazan in October, and even for 2025 ahead. So when you see this strength and depth of planning, of long-term planning, little by little, step by step, it's extremely complicated in every dossier, but they had already started and they're doing it. And the partners are eager to be part of it, to contribute, to come up with new ideas, etc. The Africans, every time the Africans come to Moscow, they are in awe. Because they will look, well, we are establishing something different together and you are helping us. With the Chinese, it's the same thing. And for over a decade, almost two decades, China investing in over 30, 35, at least 34 or 35 different African nations. Same thing. And will soon happen in some projects in Latin America, which are not part officially of Belt and Road, of New Silk Roads, but they are happening. By the end of this year, there will be the inauguration of a new port in Peru, which will be we can call it a certain Silk Road port, because it will involve exports from Brazil going to Peru and from other places in Latin America, and from this port they go all the way to Shanghai. And guess what? The main administrator of the port is Chinese. So, you know, when you put this all together, it's fantastic. It's like you're watching a 3D, 4K game of Go in front of you in a screen the size of the planet. And that's what makes it so exciting to all of us. And of course, we know with all the dangers in between.
In your opinion, with this new administration of Putin, we know that he put an economist as the head of the Ministry of Defense of Russia. And Shoigu was promoted to his new position. But when it comes to putting an economist as the head, how do you see what's the importance of this move on the part of Putin and why he's doing this, in your opinion?
It's brilliant. It's an absolutely brilliant strategic move, because it shows that the Russian Ministry of Defense and the way Russia is a semi-militarized society, because they are in the middle of a hot war against the whole West. You cannot get more hot war than that. You have a hot war on your western border against the whole collective West against you, throwing everything against you. And they will continue to throw more Wunderwaffen months after months, and money and whatever, months after months after months. You need a semi-militarized economy, and you need it run by an economist. It's as simple as it gets. Shoigu is not an economist, and Shoigu is not exactly a brilliant manager. Okay, many of you can disagree with me on that. It's okay, it's fine. But what we should all agree on is that when you have a top economist reorganizing the thrust of a semi-militarized economy that now has the most solid, the most competent military forces on the planet with zero competition from anybody. And when we get to the hypersonic domain, way ahead of anybody. So you need to streamline all that. You need a lot of cost benefits exercises. You need, you identify sectors that you need, that you know need more investment, or more stream, or even more streamlining, and nothing better than a top economist to do that. It makes perfect sense, total sense. The Chinese understood that clearly, and I'm sure the Iranians also did. They did not express it in public, at least not yet, but I'm sure they understand what that means, and including in terms of the military collaboration between Russia and Iran.
Yeah. In Switzerland, we are having a new discussion, new summit about Ukraine and what's going on in Ukraine and Russia. They didn't invite Russia. Here in Brazil, Lula said he's not going to be there, and because Russia is not there. And the head of South Africa said the same thing. We still don't know if Chinese gonna send a representative to this summit or not. But it's unbelievable the ignorance on the part of the West and why they're doing this to Russia. And because so far they didn't benefit from this animosity toward Russia, but it seems that they're doubling down. How they can get any sort of outcome from this summit without Russia?
There'll be no outcome, Nima. This is a PR operation. They may fool people who are already fooled inside what I call NATO stand, the whole space, North America to Western Europe and Eastern Europe. They can fool simpletons. They can fool people who get their information from, mainstream media. But these people are already lost in terms of being walking zombies. The people who really matter are people who make decisions. They are not fooled. The global South, the global majority, is not fooled. Everybody knows that starting today, May 20, that thing in Kiev is an illegitimate government supported by nothing, legally, certainly illegally. They are in power because they decided that they will remain in power. Nothing, there's not a single piece of paper that supports that whole congregation of gangsters starting today, May 20. So what Medvedev already said in one of his posts, if I'm not mistaken, this morning is very, very funny. Okay, whoever is the bunch of gangsters who's over there, for us, it's irrelevant. And it is. If there will be another bunch of gangsters next week or in 2 weeks, or if they throw Zelensky under the bus or not, from a Russian point of view, it doesn't matter. And it gets even worse for the West, because something that didn't happen before, the system in Russia, the Security Council, President Putin, Lavrov as foreign minister, they tried everything. And now they finally lost their patience. They don't care. So the message now that, in fact, it's not a message. Now they are telling the West outright, look, we don't care that whatever you do, we don't care. If you want to discuss Ukraine, you have to be on our terms. The war in Ukraine ends when we say so. And the only thing that is left to discuss is the modality of rendition on the terrain, which will be not only the rendition of the bunch of gangsters in Kiev, but the whole of NATO. That's it. And this is the immovable high-speed rail train, let's put it this way, Russian. And there's nothing you can move this train. You cannot derail this train anymore. There will be serious attempts to provoke a really hardcore Russian response, or in their minds, the collective West, provoke some turmoil inside Russia. And I would say that the number one preoccupation for all of us is a possible attack on the Kerch bridge this summer, which has already been announced, pre-announced. So there will be a serious attack against the Kerch bridge between June and July. And what we heard from some of our very good sources that are extremely laconic in their wisdom, but sometimes in one or two words they say, you know, oceans are contained in these words. The response, if Kiev and NATO and both try something against the Russian Federation, and especially against Kerch, is going to be the real thing, what many have been expecting for quite a while. And because this, it's beyond a red line for the bear. And the Russians have been saying it all the time. Look, think very carefully if you're attacking strategic targets, essentially civilian targets inside the Russian Federation. They are not listening. They're doubling down. So, okay, the response this time is going to be, I heard this weekend from a really, really good source. And so expect this will be the devastating response that, in fact, many people who are already also fed up, not only in Russia, but all across Eurasia, were demanding. And the provocation will come, that's for sure. It could be a false flag, it could be a direct attack with loads of SCALP and Storm Shadow missiles, maritime drones, you name it, using the new Wunderwaffen F-16s, you name it. Whatever the configuration, if there is such an attack, get ready. And then, of course, after that, all bets are off.
Yeah.
None of us can tell what could happen next, which could be something unimaginable. So we are always on the brink of something really, really serious happening, at least until the end of this year. And of course, next year, depending on who's going to be sitting at the White House, it would change the narrative a little bit, because China will become the number one existential threat. But of course, Ukraine won't disappear from one day to another. So what's so hard for the leadership in Moscow is to calibrate carefully how to advance in the battlefield, where to go, where to say, okay, that's it, when to decide, okay, we stop, and keep waiting, of course, for some sort of, I would say, fragment of dialogue from the other part, which will not come. So you have to manage all these things at the same time, nonstop. It's extremely complex, as complex as managing our transition towards a multipolar, a geoeconomic and geopolitical world.
Yeah, I think as you mentioned, the situation is so dangerous and so serious, because the first time Russia is talking about non-strategic nuclear weapons and Navy getting involved, these are really serious signs coming out of Russia, because they didn't talk about it before. It shows how serious the situation is right now. And at the same time, we've heard that a member of Bundestag in Germany was talking about Poland and Romania using the NATO air defense system and shooting everything in the western part of Ukraine. And we know that the last days of war against Nazi Germany were the bloodiest days. And do you think that we're going to witness the same thing in this conflict in Ukraine?
Could be. And that's the problem, Nima. This is the worst case scenario, which it's always I would say among the top three possible scenarios, even this year, and from this year to 2025. Because from a psychological point of view, and from the psychology of psychopaths, which is what we're all dealing with in terms of the leading political elites across NATO stand, it's absolutely impossible for them to admit that they failed on every project, that they failed on everything that has been planned, they have been planning for over 10 years, and they also failed on the battleground. They failed geoeconomically. Now they are seen as pariahs by the whole planet, literally. Like the global majority sees NATO stand as a whole as pariah states. Canada is a pariah states. France and Britain are pariah states. And even the hegemon is a pariah states in the eyes of 87, 88, 89% of the world's population. This is a fact. And they will never recover from that. And compounded to the fact that they are enabling, authorizing, weaponizing, and justifying a genocide in Gaza. With all that, that's it. You know, the lines could not be clearer, in fact. So what do they have left? Provoke a hot war, an enormous hot war, and which, of course, they will be the first ones to disappear if they do that. Of course, in their minds, no, we are protected, whatever. The same crap that they try to convince themselves of, this crap all the time. So the key on a human basis, the impossibility of rational people sitting down at the same table and discuss, which is the basics of diplomacy as we know it. It doesn't exist anymore. They only know how to issue threats, sanctions, and organize scenarios where, in their minds, they can corral their enemies or destabilize their enemies from the outside, or much better, from the inside. One of the key readings that these people are making of what happened with Raisi's helicopter is how to use the whole thing to destabilize Iran. It's the only thing that matters for them. There's nothing else. So we could draw a list of these past few weeks of a series of coincidences, and the targets, voluntarily, involuntarily, coincidentally, not so coincidentally, in a very dodgy manner, etc., they happen to be, all of them, actors who understand perfectly what Russia, China is doing, or are defending Russia and China, or are on the same camp as Russia and China, and or are being protected directly, indirectly, or on the background by China. So this won't disappear. On the contrary, this is part of the current hybrid war, which is now a hot hybrid war. The only thing left for these elites is, okay, let's try to destabilize everyone, everybody, anywhere. That's it. A series of attempts at color revolutions, attempts on political leaders, to provoke mini hybrid wars and mini color revolutions anywhere they can, to keep important people they are against them in jail, the case of Imran Khan in Pakistan, for instance. So this is where we are, you know. And of course, Russia, China, they know this absolutely. Coming back to the meeting that Putin had with his defense team and the Iranian ambassador in Moscow, they know exactly what's going on. So, you know, at least they know. What they cannot predict, of course, is where the next coincidence will happen, and who is going to be the next one to be targeted.
It seems at least we know that in Georgia there are some coincidences going on. And
Yeah, there is a coincidence going on in Georgia, is that by the
We know that in Georgia there is a law passed in the parliament, law on foreign agents. And the parliament passed this law, and then the president of Georgia vetoed this law. And we, at the same time, we were seeing protests on the streets. And it's so amazing to see the foreign ministers of Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia participating in these protests in Georgia. How dangerous is this, and why they're doing this in a foreign country? Foreign ministers, it's so amazing why they're doing this, in your opinion. This is just before our eyes they're doing color revolution. I don't know how we can call it.
Or let's call it the Baltic Chihuahua color revolution, Nima, because the Baltic Chihuahuas, they have nothing better to do with their lives. These are three mega insignificant pieces of land, not very far from St. Petersburg, for that matter. So, so they hop on a plane, they go to Georgia, and they support a color revolution, which is clearly instigated, organized, financed, etc., by the Americans. That's the only thing they know how to do. Okay, why don't you cross the border? Why don't you go to Russia? Why don't you try to call a revolution inside Russia? You'll be turned into Chicken Kiev in 5 minutes, all of you Baltic Chihuahuas. So it's a joke. This should not even be considered as serious players because they aren't. But of course, they figure in the organization of NATO as the Americans see it for the future. And this, I would say, is even bipartisan in Washington. They want a NATO that is basically controlled, that they control, of course, they continue to control. But the main actors are going to be London, Warsaw, the Baltic Chihuahuas, because Project Ukraine collapsed. So no more Ukraine in the picture. So what's left for them is London, Warsaw, and the three Chihuahuas. So, of course, they use the Chihuahuas to instigate color revolutions in the post-Soviet space, which is what's happening now with Georgia. And considering that Project Ukraine failed, we are back to Project Georgia, which of course never left the picture. It was just in the background. So now it's back again. It's so we have to be tired because we're always dealing with the same bunch of idiots doing the same bunch of stupidity thing over and over again. The problem is, of course, this concerns vast regions, whole populations, serious regions in several nodes of the planet, and the consequences of all that, they are terrible. And we cannot escape it. We cannot even prevent it, which is what Russians, especially, even more than the Chinese, would like to do, but it's impossible. You would need that 20 Russian administrations with 20 defense teams to try to prevent all that. And with the millions of informants spread all over, especially the post-Soviet space, you can't.